Okay. Welcome to this interview that we have the great privilege of meeting with Daniela Sciano Di Cola. How'd I do?
Not bad, actually. It's Sciano.
Sciano? I was studying Italian and I was so close. She's the. I forget that the CH is different in Italian from Spanish.
Yeah.
She's the project coordinator for Diplomatic Language Services, which is a government contractor for preparing language content for government employees who need to learn foreign languages. She's the instructional designer for foreign language textbooks and interactive online activities. She's worked primarily with government contracts for language materials and has experience developing activities for 7 languages alongside subject matter experts. She has worked with interactive online blended learning courses and has been the point person for a team of content developers. So we're really happy to have Daniela with us today. She has a great background and experience and great insight to share with us around the actual content development around language learning, a lot of the textbooks and other things that all of us as teachers make use of. So thank you so much for joining us, Daniela.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me.
So I guess we'll jump right into the interview questions. The first one we have is about the open movement. So we're just kind of wondering what your reaction is to the open movement, including open content and Creative Commons rights. And alongside that, do you think that individuals and organizations who provide open content will be able to match the quality of content produced with copyrights reserved? And then also, how should the open communities and, I guess, instructors in general assure quality in open materials?
Well, I think the open movement is incredible. I think it's really exciting and can take education to become accessible to anyone who really wants to seek it. I think there are pros and cons with it. For one thing, there's a lot of information available, and sometimes that can be really overwhelming if it's not kind of organized in a way that's useful to the learner, or if the learner doesn't know how to organize it for themselves.
Yeah, I'm really glad that you said that. I think that's actually really interesting, and it's something that I found personally when I was looking for, especially when I was looking for open materials to organize the first Spanish MOOC. I kind of thought, oh, you know, open education, open courseware, I should be able to find an entire Spanish course somewhere. But I found exactly what you're describing, this plethora of content and no way to organize it.
Right.
And almost no, like, complete courses that actually take you from point A to point B in language learning. It's all just kind of all out there.
Right. I think people in the beginning were really excited and just started amassing information in a lot of different places. And I think the cool thing that's happening now is that people who are interested in organizing this information and creating educational materials are coming out and being creative and finding new ways to present language learning materials. And I mean, it's not just restricted to language learning, but I mean, being really interested in languages and linguistics, I think it's fascinating how it can be developed in that particular field, because there's so many opportunities for sharing content, for just experiencing kind of like simulated, even thinking about like virtual worlds and simulated realities and scenarios. Like, those go really well with practicing to learn a new language and culture.
I agree completely. And I actually think that has a great deal to do with why the MOOC, this massive open online course movement, has really been getting so much traction.
Yeah.
Especially with my personal kind of experience of it. I think before the MOOC, we had all this open courseware, OCW, and you had like MIT open courseware where you'd have these professors just kind of throwing over the fence hundreds of syllabi and just tons of like readings and content and all this disorganized stuff, just kind of stuffing it all into this OpenCourseWare stuff. But it was never organized into a place that, the consumers of the content could ever actually get to it or access it. Whereas the MOOC now organizes it and puts an instructor around that openness and makes it entirely different.
Yeah, it's really great.
Yeah, I think, well, and Scott keeps mentioning this point of the lack of organization. I think one of the key things here with OpenCourseWare or any kind of open content is that it's generally supplied as, you know, people who own chunks of content say, oh, we can get the license for this to work out, or, you know, we're able to get permission to release this stuff, and then they just kind of dump an archive. So it's almost like a big open repository that these colleges have kind of just sort of dumped onto the web, or even sometimes into YouTube channels. But you know, that there's a big difference, I think, between having just raw content available and then actually developing the content into a course. And I think a lot of that kind of gets taken for granted, maybe from an instructor's perspective, where, you know, of course, instructors start with generally a pretty decent, or you know, they actually start with what you guys prepare, which is this actual followable curriculum that takes the student through, and the teacher can kind of create their lessons based on it. And I think Scott, you know, had a firsthand chance to realize how much work it is what you guys do in taking, you know, materials and building it into an actual course.
Yeah, definitely. And also the idea of having a repository, it's kind of like the difference of actually attending a college course or just having a college library to your hands. Like, even though you have all of the information, you still need someone to guide you through it and to kind of show you step by step the, like, where to start and things like that.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah. So do you have any thoughts on any way that these open communities or anything can mitigate the risk of this just kind of disorganized library of materials without any organization about it, or how they can assure quality in open materials?
Do you mean quality in the actual materials that are provided, or like within courses?
Which do you think is a greater issue?
Sorry, say that again?
Which of those do you think is a bigger issue? Do you think the material itself is high quality, but that it's not organized into high quality courses?
Well, I think that it's harder to assure quality in materials. But when I think of materials, I'm thinking of, like, usable content, so like videos, images, texts, those kind of things. So I feel like there's a lot of that available, and it's really up to the person designing the course to assure the quality and choosing what works best in the course syllabus or the design that they're seeking. So I kind of see all of the materials as kind of like a palette, and they just need to pick and choose like the right ones when the time is right. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I really like that analogy.
Yeah, because you can't really control how many materials are out there, because people will keep producing, and they're, you know, it's, there's a lot to choose from. That maybe there can be like an organization or a website who's, and I'm sure this exists already and I'm just not aware of it, that, and I mean, there are the Centers for Language Resource or Language Acquisition Resource Centers. They kind of act like that, where they have libraries of Creative Common materials that language instructors can access. So there are kind of like libraries, online libraries that provide quality materials, and that they're kind of weeding it out for you.
Oh, I've heard of a few generalized ones. I wasn't aware of any language learning ones, but my general perception as kind of an educator looking for some of these resources is that there's just so much stuff in these archives that it's so hard to like really make a query, an effective query out of what you're trying to look for and actually finding the good high quality stuff.
Right. Yeah, that is always a feeling. Sorry, did you say, do I get that feeling?
Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely do. We use Scola a lot. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Scola.
Scola is about.
I want to look up what the acronym is, actually. It's a website that is not open source, but I think it... they provide a license to educational organizations to use their content. But it's for language learning, and they have a lot of different types of content. They have specific images from regions all over the world. They have fully kind of developed classes that are kind of similar. They're like surrounded by or around either one video or one audio. They have like online TV or international TV channels, international radio, international newspapers, and you can just take those and use it as your content. And it's all authentic. It's all authentic material.
Thanks so much for sharing. That sounds really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Let me find what the acronym stands for. It's S-C-O-L-A. But let's see.
Okay. I guess this kind of transitions us to the next question while you're looking that up. As an instructional designer, I'm curious what you think the future of learning materials and especially publication looks like. And I know that you had mentioned that you created paper textbooks and some materials with those. So I was wondering, do you think those will always have a place in education, or where do you think the direction is headed?
I definitely think it'll still have a place in education. I mean, even though most of what I'm working on is printed materials, there's still a lot of kind of interactive aspects to it. We still attach videos, attach audios, have websites, direct students to go to websites within the textbook. And I think that's how the textbook is kind of evolving to kind of incorporate digital media within it. And I just think it'll still be around because there's so many different learning styles, and not everyone is going to be attracted by learning online. And I think it's good to offer those different options. And I feel like some people might like the combination, the blended learning experience of having something kind of to follow that's printed, but also online. Does that make sense?
Definitely. Yeah, we absolutely agree with that. And in fact, in our Spanish MOOC class, we are designing the platforms. So every time we think of a need, we think, okay, well, can we use technology to solve this? And one of the specific ones was we wanted to have students keep a journal of the different things that they were learning, the different grammar points, and, just keep their own notes, because it's so important for so many students, as you were mentioning, to have that, you know, physical thing to look at and to actually write things down and organize it in their own way. And we thought, well, we could make a technological solution for this and maybe make it part of our online platform. It's like, no, you know, there's so much benefit to having the ability to write things down and go over them in your own way without being forced to enter it into a computer program or put it on a website. So,
I'm still a very visual learner with writing. I need to see it written out before I can really remember it.
Yeah, I'm actually the same way. And people always make fun of me when in an interview or something. I'm always taking like 5-6 pages of notes, but it's not necessarily that I'm going to go back and read each thing that I wrote, but it really helps me to write as I'm listening.
Yeah. I think I had something else to say on this point.
Sure.
Oh, the future of learning materials. So I'm really excited about the prospect of using or kind of like traveling to different places in the world, but online, so that using things like Google Earth or something similar to Google Earth, and kind of experiencing the location of where you're, of what language you're learning, and kind of like simulated worlds, but also, I don't know, I have this kind of idea of using kind of like Skype, but with an iPad, and traveling, having like an instructor take you out to, say, like a cafe in Honduras. I don't know, I just remember that country. But sorry, maybe I'm not explaining myself very clearly.
No, actually, what you're describing sounds a lot like the interview we had with Catherine just a couple of days ago. She actually talked about when she had her class go on a field trip. They actually went to Paris and saw some of the famous sites in Paris. And what they would do is, since only a portion of her class was able to go with, they would involve the students who stayed behind online. So they would actually, you know, upload all the different photos they took, and they would use like geotagging and you know, Foursquare, all these different things to help them see on Google Earth where it was. And it turned into this really cool, like really exactly the epitome of blended learning, where you have, you know, students who are learning from other students online, and then other students who are interacting in the physical world. And I think there's just a ton of potential for that, especially as, you know, these cool technological tools come out that that bring our world, our physical world and our digital world, closer and closer together.
Yeah, definitely. And I really think that has a place in language learning and language education.
Yeah, so much of it is about the culture, right? I really like that idea. I think I'm actually going to recommend that as part of one of the weeks, I'll see where we can fit it into the LT MOOC schedule, but that you investigate at least one city of the language you're trying to learn and figure out how to use Google Earth so you can take your class on a field trip there. I like that. I love that, actually.
Yeah, going to different places in the city.
Yeah.
And visiting, like, national historic monuments, things like that. You can do that and just from your computer and talking about it.
Yeah, and it was fun. Actually, when I was planning my trip to Europe with my wife, who's actually from Honduras, so it's funny that you should mention Honduras, she and I would pull up Google Earth and pull up each of the cities we were going to. So we went to Madrid, Paris, Athens, and Rome. So we looked at like all the different sites and kind of thought, okay, what are we going to do in each of these cities? And we actually pulled up the streets of the different cities. And then when we got there, we were like, well, this really makes it come alive for us. But at least we got the, the first sense of it before we went. It was cool.
That is really cool.
Okay. Continuing on the topic of the future of learning, I'm sure you've heard about this term adaptive learning. So we're curious, what do you know about it, and what kind of is the feeling among content developers and those subject matter experts when it comes to designing courses? Do you think about adaptive learning?
Yeah, definitely.
Go ahead.
No, I do think about it. And I mean, the way I understand it is that with kind of an online course where it'll adapt to the student as that student is learning. So if the student kind of misses a certain point, the software will pick up on that and then reiterate it enough times until the student feels comfortable with it and has learned that particular item.
Yeah, that's a great succinct description of adaptive learning. Thank you for that.
Sure. But it's really hard to do kind of with limited software. Not to say that the software is limited, but I think that idea hasn't quite caught up with some rapid courseware authoring tools, in that they'll allow you to kind of give feedback to the student. But I would like to see more the ability to give specific feedback for specific answers and kind of build on that. And that's really going to take someone who's able to develop their own software, obviously, to reach that point. But it would be great to start seeing software that is for language-specific course authoring, which I guess is what you guys are kind of doing.
Yeah, it's definitely one of our goals. And, you know, I think there's actually been a little bit of criticism or pushback from teachers on adaptive learning. So we're trying to find the right balance. And the place I see teachers pushing back on adaptive learning is actually regarding adaptive learning versus adaptive teaching. And they're saying, you know, why do we need software to get in the way of deciding which principles our students need to learn, when we as teachers can clearly see this student is struggling with, you know, conjugating a star? You know, we don't need a software program to ask them a bunch of questions and try to decipher that when we can already provide that feedback. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that that we kind of try to do with adaptive learning, which, you know, I think it really connects back to what you were just saying, where, you know, it would be nice for the software to be able to pick up with what the teacher can already identify. And so that's one of the things we've really tried to do with InStreamia, is make it completely teacher-centric and to really pull the information in for the teacher so that it can, first of all, benefit from the tremendous resource and incredible teaching abilities that a teacher already has. And, you know, I think if we're trying to invent a machine which can replace a teacher, we've got a long ways to go. Yeah. But if we're trying to come up with, you know, useful tools that help teachers identify trends in their classroom and work through that, then I think, you know, we can already be there, and we can already create something which just really augments the incredible ability that teachers already have.
Well, that would be interesting to. I would be interested to know how you would approach something like that, especially if I'm just thinking with kind of common errors that students make in grammar or kind of like.
Yeah, let me tell you a little bit about how we did it for Spanish MOOC.
Sure.
So we had in excess of 3,000 students actually submitting assignments, and I actually reached out to as many groups and organizations of teachers and kind of good people who would be willing to volunteer their time to help grade these assignments, because I honestly couldn't do it. There's not enough time. And so I found about 45 people, all Spanish natives actually, who most of them taught Spanish as a foreign language. And we started to approach this grading of literally thousands of homework assignments. And wow. What we did is we kind of started to categorize the different mistakes that people would make. So take, for example, introducing yourself. I'm not sure how familiar you are with Spanish in particular, but in Spanish, they tended to misuse the verbs ser and estar. They mm-hmm. tended to misuse the verb llamar for me llamo. They tended to misuse the expression of age with tener. And so we came up with this list of 10 common errors, basically from the data. We would take hundreds of comments from different reviewers and say which are the most commonly occurring things that students are messing up. And then we would actually send it back to the learners after having graded something like 15% of the homework assignments. We would send it back to the learners and say, hey, this is one common mistake, and I'd record a video about how you could avoid making this mistake and do this for the 10 most common errors, send it back to them, have them learn from those errors, and then resubmit their homework assignment. And so that took a lot of the pain out of the grading the homework assignments, because there were fewer errors.
Right. Well, that's really a really good idea, especially with the with having so many students and homework assignments, to just yeah. kind of point the common errors, because a lot of I feel like if you're an English speaker learning whatever language you're learning, there's always going to be those kind of assumptions that come from knowing English in the new language. And right. Those, where like the common errors come from. So you can really pinpoint like why are you thinking this way? Because it's not completely random. It's probably most likely connected to the syntax of English.
Exactly. And from a content development perspective, now I have, you know, 10 or so assignments that I know the 10 most common errors for. So now when I design the curriculum for kind of the version 2.0 of the course, I can go back and say, hey, you might make these mistakes. Try to avoid them.
Yeah. Well, there you go. That's one way of just assuring quality, is to keep learning in every single course what works best for the students.
Yeah, that's really cool how it ties back into our earlier question that, you know, that the quality assurance. And I think that's where a lot of the interesting development can happen, right? We already have really interesting and great materials. There's tons and tons of libraries of it. But where it really becomes interesting is how do the students actually interact with those materials, and what can we learn from how they're interacting with them, and how can we improve it? I think that's really interesting that this kind of a development of adaptive learning. And of course, one of the really cool things with language learning is there's so many tiny, tiny little sample points you can get by looking at the way students respond to these specific questions we've designed that test their understanding of a specific vocabulary item. And, you know, I think adaptive learning isn't really something that's all that new. If a student is doing their own flashcards, for example, if you have a big stack of flashcards and mm-hmm. you keep getting one wrong, you know, you learn that you need to maybe review that flashcard more than some of the other flashcards as you go through the stack. And so, like, students kind of know how to do this, but, you know, it's nice to put some of the scientific rigor we have on the way the mind actually works, and to kind of fine-tune some of these processes that we've been using for a long time.
Yeah. I was just going to add to that and say to really understand how to integrate it with the new technology.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So I wanted to talk for a second about one point that you mentioned earlier, which was what I've heard called kind of the feedback loop, where mm-hmm. you have a student trying to produce outputs and then a teacher kind of trying to correct those outputs in the right direction, and then the student, you know, trying to produce more outputs and kind of honing the student output so that it's actually right.
Right.
How do you develop content around this sort of feedback loop? Or is this something that you guys try to approach in your content development? Or could you tell us a little bit about what you think about it?
Sure. Let me think about that for a second.
Yeah, sorry. This one kind of came up as I was listening to you.
Well, what I was thinking when I brought it up was more with self-study modules that we are developing for a blended learning course. So the student works on this particular course 2 days a week, and then meets with the teacher 3 days a week.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
And one of the things I really wanted to do was incorporate very specific feedback to the student for each potential answer to, say, like multiple choice questions or fill in the blank or, like choose the correct response to a question or a statement and those types of activities. I wanted to create something that would recognize what the student chose, kind of be able to give them information about why it's wrong and why, and like a hint to what the correct answer would be, which I haven't really found a way to do yet with the current software I'm using.
I really like that, and I think there's a lot of information. I'm kind of a data geek by trade, but there's a lot of data not only in which questions they're getting wrong, but also in what answer they chose, right?
Yeah.
I think
that's the most important. If you write very good distractors, and yep. So it's very it can be very telling as to why a student chose the wrong answer.
Yeah, definitely. And we're actually working with a PhD graduate, or just a PhD in data development and machine learning, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that we're kind of going through this data we've collected from Spanish MOOC, is to kind of figure out, okay, so based on these distractors that we gave them, what can we learn and what can we use in that information in preparing the next question? And so the idea is, maybe if you're doing, well, maybe a simple example is almost reminiscent of the way the GRE works, where it does this kind of, I think they call it bracketing, where you kind of start with a question that, you know, would maybe you can determine their level in a wider range, and then you kind of hone in from there. But for example, if you're doing a pronunciation exercise, you could start out with five different words that all begin with a different letter and have different lengths, you know, very, very different words. And then as they start to get those right, kind of hone in and say, okay, well, let's use distractors that are much more similar. And I don't know, an interesting one I can think of for maybe a Japanese person learning English is, you could give them words where everything's the same except for the L's and the R's are switched, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be an opportunity for them to focus on distinguishing just those two words. So you can kind of get really specific with what you want to test, depending on how you design these distractors.
Yeah. That sounds very interesting to know, to find out how you can do that like online or like with the software.
Yeah, and I mean, the really cool thing about putting it into one concise, tightly managed data system like we have is we can take experts in machine learning, like this PhD that we're working with, and
mm-hmm.
you know, we can immediately start implementing new algorithms where, okay, if they get this right, let's try giving them that question. And so you can really get a long ways in the data that,
right.
you know, you don't have to wait for the results to be collected and then go through and redesign questions. You can kind of do it on the fly.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of one of the exciting things we're trying to bring to the content development world. All the while we're trying to innovate on the teaching world and the school world. You know, we're kind of got our a lot of irons in the fire. We're working in a lot of frontiers simultaneously. So it really helps to talk with.
Yeah,
you
but
know.
It's very inspiring. It's very inspiring and very exciting to see that something like this is developing fast in language learning.
Yeah, I think, and it's really just getting started. And I think that by getting people together, getting the right people together and having the right conversations, and I think LT MOOC is going to do just this, we can really start to develop a tool that works together and accomplishes all of these important purposes, whether it be the feedback loops of a student getting things wrong, or aggregating data to determine how the curriculum should be developed, or
mm-hmm.
just on a student-by-student basis, how can we give them a better multiple-choice question? How can we challenge them at the right level to learn the right thing that they need to learn, you know, in the next 10 seconds, for
yeah.
example? So like even in these short time windows, or these longer time windows, there's just all kinds of opportunities to really develop and improve the language learning process.
Right. So we've been talking a lot about asynchronous learning. I want to know,
yeah.
have you guys been doing a lot of any, I know you use Google Hangout to have conversations. Something I'm really interested in is looking into kind of virtual classroom web conferencing tools that are specifically designed for language learning, which I haven't exactly found yet. But
is that either synchronous or asynchronous, or one or the other?
Synchronous. So meeting, kind of like if you've used some web conferencing tools like GoToMeeting or WebEx, something
yeah.
like that, but where the entire conferencing tool is designed for foreign language learning.
So what features would you imagine in a synchronous learning tool that would be specific to language learning?
Well, it would have to be very, very interactive. It would have to be able to kind of share everything, share video, share audio, and not just webcam video and like audio as we're doing now, but also like kind of videos from websites, videos from YouTube, different audios, being able to do screen sharing, to look at websites together, have a shared browser, all of those features, which all of them do exist in most of these conferencing tools, but there are a lot of aspects to it that are not, I don't find appealing for teaching foreign languages. And I think the kind of the virtual classroom space and the way that these features are advertised can be optimized for foreign language.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Those are some great ideas that I hadn't really thought of myself. I know that I think teachers have all kind of come up with their own sort of solution using the existing technology to kind of create the learning experience they want. Ed Dixon, for example, who's at UPenn that we interviewed last week, he mentioned how he would have his students interact through, well, a wide variety of media, but in one of his synchronous ones, he would have them typing into the chat windows while he was discussing a principle to see. So even if he's discussing with one student, the other students still have to be engaged by typing into the chat window and putting in their response. What's that?
That's good too. I mean, I most of the time when I'm thinking about it, I think of kind of one-on-one or one to like three students, but I could see how it can be a little bit more complicated if there's a large classroom learning one language in web conferencing.
Right. Yeah. In his case, he said he does about 10 students, I think, in a class. So still, you know, orders of magnitude smaller than the MOOC stuff that we're doing, but enough people that you can't necessarily do a one-on-one the entire time.
Well, you can do breakout rooms, I think, too, which is cool.
So that's kind of the sort of stuff that he was doing. So I think there is some interesting, like, innovation on this front where people are kind of using the sort of stuff that has come up. But I haven't heard of any company which has actually tried to tackle this specific problem from a language teaching perspective. So I'm sure there's a lot of, like, low-hanging fruit that might exist there. And maybe someday we can get to, you know, focusing more of our effort on that, especially once we get our mobile apps out, because I think trying to do this sort of stuff on the computer or in the web browser can be really difficult. You know, it's amazing what Google has been able to do and some of these other ones, but most of them are actually using, like, you know, software you have to download just because it's such a complicated space when you have so many different web browsers.
I can imagine. Well, there are open source. Have you heard of Big Blue Button?
I have. I think I've heard of it.
I know there's
that open source video sharing.
Yeah, I think it's an open source software. I think it's. I think that there's a community of developers, and you know, I think they welcome people taking the software and customizing it to their needs.
Sure. Yeah, that's definitely an interesting front to look into. One thing we have looked into, and one thing we already do, is we'll do, just as we're doing today, we'll do a Google Hangout, and we'll record it and put the whole thing into YouTube, and then we can import it back into our content library so all of the students can learn from that conversation. And then we put our interactive subtitles and exercises built from that, you know, that Hangout. So it's pretty cool. We can actually create content, really great specific content to address, you know, whatever gap we find in the existing content. So say, for example, and this is one that came up in Spanish MOOC, because we need some dialogues that use the preterite tense, you know, and kind of focus on the preterite tense so students can get the necessary practice with that. And so what we did was we had one of our students in the class, or actually I think it was a grader in the class, Javier, who is in, I think he's from Spain, gave this really, really cool, you know, biographical account of his own life and some experiences. And he used lots of the preterite tense doing so. And we used that as one of the source materials. And so, you know, we can do this kind of stuff. We can get more natural conversation than you would in just a regular content preparation, perhaps, by having actual native speakers have an actual conversation. You know, it's like, whoa, yeah. That's such a simple idea, but
that's all you need is just real conversations.
Yeah, yeah.
And the ability to dissect it, which is, it's really fun, I think, to dissect language and learn from it.
Yeah, and it's so much different. You know, it's interesting. If you go to, like, YouTube and search for language lessons in English or something, you'll find all these really popular channels of people who have, in one way or another, appealed to people learning English. But oftentimes, the actual dialogues that they have, they're not realistic. They're kind of terrible. And, you know, maybe they're good at learning, good for learning or something. But at the same time, you kind of, you know, as a native English speaker, I always do this double take. And I'm like, really? I've never used that phrase before, so.
Yeah. I'm not sure how I feel about that. I feel like it is very difficult to write natural, very natural dialogues, especially if you have a specific set of vocabulary words and a specific grammar point that you're trying to incorporate.
Right.
But yeah, it's definitely very hard. One of the biggest issues I think we had with our content developers writing dialogues is the tendency to just kind of try to fit all of the vocabulary words into one quick, like, 2-minute conversation.
Yeah.
I think that's a huge no, you know, just kind of like your vocabulary list is a category of tools or something.
Right.
And your line is, I need to go to the store to buy a hammer and a wrench and and sure, like the student is practicing to hear these vocabulary words, but there, you know, there's like a lack in kind of culture and the way that people really talk in that kind of approach.
Yeah. And that's actually an interesting development that we've, and an approach that we've incorporated into our methodology. Instead of having content developers or teachers develop lists of words which then drive content, we try to develop the most natural content that we can use to teach a principle.
And then pull the words from there.
And pull the words systematically through natural language processing and say, these are the words you need to learn to understand this task or this principle.
Right.
Yeah, I really like that approach.
Yeah, actually, my Japanese class that I took in college did a similar approach where they went through and found, like, these simple Japanese stories. So they're almost akin to, like, Aesop's Fables or something like that. And the first one was this really simple story that, you know, wasn't as long as the others. But then the next one got, like, a little bit more complicated. And by the end of the book, we just sort of gradually built up all these characters we needed to use to read through these stories, which, of course, in Japanese, you know, building up from story to story, you're actually learning hundreds of new characters. So mm-hmm. It's kind of an intense process. But
you have a kind of
actually very natural.
Yeah, like you have a very specific reason for learning that character instead of just needing to memorize a single unit.
Exactly. And with Japanese, for as many characters as they have, if you, you know, even if you schedule it out and tell them we're going to learn characters 1 through 100, 200 through 300, you know, it gets to be extremely monotonous and really, really repetitive. So.
Yeah, and I know, especially with all learners, actually, I think there needs to be a very clear purpose to learning.
Yeah.
In all aspects.
Yeah, actually, that goes really well with what Gretchen was saying, which was that for time that the students spend on task, you have to reward them with something that they can truly use and they can feel good about knowing. So it kind of motivates them to keep going. So that's been kind of a recurring theme throughout the interviews we've had with our experts in this MOOC. So thanks for bringing that up.
Cool. Yeah, it's great to reaffirm correct principles.
Yeah, definitely.
So this is something that we were talking about a little bit earlier, about how this content that you develop, and especially when we were talking a little bit about open materials, how you have this huge archive of available materials that you can pull from. You see teachers pulling together kind of their own lessons, and I'm curious for you as a content developer who more delivers complete solutions as opposed to contributes to this archive or this vat of materials that people can pull from. Do you find that teachers actually follow the prescribed materials, or do they tend to kind of still do their own thing based on the textbook or materials that are developed?
Well, so I don't have a lot of personal experience with this because I don't work directly with a lot of the instructors who use our materials. But I have talked to some of the instructors on this topic, and it really seems to come down to the teacher's kind of experience and how long they've been teaching, what kind of materials they've developed on their own over time, and how they feel about the curriculum, I think. So I've heard that, and also I think it depends on the program they're teaching in. So I know that there are some programs that are very strict about following the curriculum, especially in kind of government and military language training. They really want their instructors to follow the textbook step by step because it's very closely tailored to what the soldiers need to know. So that in that case, I'm sure that this instructors have a little bit of freedom, but maybe not as much as an instructor in a K-12 or university setting would.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And also,
thinking back to an earlier interview that we had. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Sorry. Another thing I think affects it a lot is sometimes they're very kind of obscure languages, not obscure, but less commonly taught languages that we're developing materials for. And in those cases, you're more likely to have instructors with less experience and also less materials to access.
Interesting.
Sometimes that might be kind of the only and most reliable source that they have.
Right, that makes sense. So do you occasionally develop materials for, you know, like very obscure languages, like, in the Philippines, they speak Tagalog would be the most
right.
common
yeah.
one, but there's also
Tagalog is actually one of the languages we're working on now.
Okay. Yeah, I know there's a lot of military need for those languages as well, but yeah, I think Cebuano is like the lesser common of a fairly uncommon language. So like it gets to be, you know, really, really niche.
And I think one of them that surprised me was we did some materials for Quechuan.
Okay.
Quechuan is pretty.
Where's Quechuan spoken?
In South America. In like the Amazon.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure. Let me check myself before.
That's okay.
interview.
Yeah, I didn't know that one actually. So yeah, there's so many languages. It's interesting that we imagine there's maybe like 10, maybe 100 languages, but I think the most recent estimates that there's currently about 4,000 languages, and that actually they're dying off very rapidly. So every year we lose several of those languages.
And that's a really, that's an interesting field too, to go into kind of language revitalization and to help create content for languages that don't have any. But yeah, Quechua is spoken in Central Andes of South America in Peru.
Huh.
Okay. Interesting.
Oh, interesting. All the way in Peru. Oh, did you say South America? I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Central. Oh,
No,
wow.
Central Andes. I'm sorry, the Central Andes.
Oh, okay. That
Oh,
makes
okay.
sense. Well, yeah, and it's really, I think that's one of the really important things of being a content developer and content curator is, in some sense, you're actually preserving those languages and making those languages available when and making them available in a recorded format when they otherwise wouldn't be, and may be lost to the world completely. Even if though that may not be the immediate goal, every piece of content that's developed and saved and recorded for these languages, I think, can become, a really important source into the future. So, very
Yeah,
cool.
and hopefully it can be used to for the current speakers to teach their children and to keep the language alive. I think that's
Yeah,
very important.
absolutely. Yeah, it's really cool. Yeah, and I think now that we have the technology to record and produce so much content, the opportunity is really there to keep more of these languages alive than maybe would have been possible otherwise.
That's
But still, definitely something we need to, have an active awareness of in order to do well, I think. And maybe that's one of the important tasks of going forward is just organizing this information that we have, and this curriculum and content that we've developed into, searchable and indexed archives, which, in Streamio, we're just this tiny little company with this big goal of incorporating as much as we can into these courses for people to actually teach from and learn from. So we're a long ways from achieving any huge archiving goals, but we hope it's, a step in the right direction.
There, have you heard of the speech archive or speech accent archive?
I think I was reading about that actually not too long ago, but I don't know much about it.
I think it's called that, or the International Dialects of English Archive.
Oh, okay. So this is for English.
Yeah, they've recorded just hundreds of people speaking a particular sentence and from different accents.
Wow, that's quite an undertaking.
It's an archive of English accents.
Huh.
But something like that, but for just all languages, not just English accents, would be really cool too.
Yeah, definitely. It reminds me of like some of the really strange accents that like my grandparents have, and I'm like, I don't really hear people use like some of these words anymore. And even the other day, like my mom was using some phrase. I was like, what does that mean? Is
Yeah.
that really a phrase? And then of course it is, In her day it was like a phrase everyone knew, and now it's like one of those things where you think you've heard it before.
It's
Absolutely.
always important to remember that language always changes all the time, everywhere,
Yeah,
in between
that's so true.
everyone.
And I think that's one of the great things that's happening with the faster development cycles in content development that we see now, where people are it's very less com it's much less common for people to use a textbook that's 10 years old now that we have the internet and you can easily
Right.
get to online and live materials. So very cool.
Yeah. Yeah,
Yeah,
and it's
that's
important to keep that updated. And that's a cool, yeah, another cool thing about it being online is that people will always be updating it and, commenting, and it'll just keep up with the language of the times.
right. And it's been an especially interesting experience for me, thinking that I was somewhat knowledgeable in Spanish, having spoken it for over 10 years and taught it in a variety of contexts and other things like that. When I'm put into this worldwide Spanish MOOC with students and graders from 20 different countries, I'm like, I would be the one to say, you can't use that phrase. I've never heard that before. And then somebody else would say, well, in Peru.
There's
so many different variations of Spanish. I can't even imagine.
Yeah, Spanish
Have
is
you thought
definitely.
about offering different variations? Like Spain Spanish, Central American Spanish, or anything like that?
Right, yeah. Even within Central America, Guatemalans will say one thing for the word pencil, and Hondurans will say another. Even within Honduras, people in Santa Rosa will say one thing, and people in in San Pedro will say it's crazy.
Yeah, pretty amazing. But I mean, that just accentuates the need to have kind of this collaborative area for people to interact, which Spanish MOOC has kind of become just because there's been so many people of so many geographical and regions that it's kind of become this really interesting battleground for what's correct in Spanish, like right on our website. So
Yeah,
we
I
have.
kind of saw that with some of the
One
comments.
grader telling him one thing, and then another person from another country will chime in and say, "Actually." So it's been really interesting in that way, and I think it's been one of the things that's frustrating as a student of Spanish when I was a kid is that every time I got a new Spanish teacher in high school, they would tell us the things we were saying were wrong, and it was like, "Wait a minute, but that other teacher just said this," and it's like, "Is there really not a correct word for like car?" And they'd all had different experiences, and it was so hard for me as a young student of Spanish to grasp what those differences were, why they existed. But I think for students in a collaborative online course like a MOOC, they're able to see, okay, we've got people from all over the place with all different kinds of speaking, but at this, even though some people are kind of surprised by these phrases, it generally gets communicated. So, you don't have to give up on the language over it, but it is really interesting and it's really easy to be aware of when you see it
It
happening
really
in front of you.
opens the door for a lot of cultural information and just talking about different cultures. Like, why do you say it like this here, and you say it like that over there, and that kind of can really just bring you a lot of interesting conversation.
Absolutely. And interesting is so important in language learning. In learning, I'll extend that. If it's not interesting, you don't learn it. It doesn't stick with you, right? So having social conversations about, earlier we were having a conversation about whether it's El Radio or La Radio. It's silly, but these people are never going to forget the whether it's which one is correct and where you use the different article for this word now that they've had this conversation about it. So it's a really great mnemonic and kind of this encoding, semantic encoding of principles for have the social interaction around concepts.
Definitely. And then a lot of people become very passionate about the way they say things. So I think that
It's
can
so
really.
true. And that interesting thing I think is being involved in the edtech space, and I'm going on a little bit of a tangent here, but there's so many tools out there that are trying to mix in interesting games with learning because learning is this boring, tedious thing that you have to get through. So if we add in Space Invaders every third question, maybe the students will be able to keep doing their homework. Like this is honestly the approach of dozens of edtech companies out there. But what we think is that the learning itself can be really interesting if you can get it in the right context and if you can get the right people connecting in the right ways, that the interactions can be really interesting. So, I mean,
Yeah,
that's
definitely
we haven't added any Space Invaders games into our platform yet. And
that.
I don't want to say for sure that we won't. No, I'm just kidding. But no, so I mean, I really
Maybe
don't think
the
that
aliens are
that's.
speaking Spanish.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and I mean, I don't mean to belittle gamification because I think there's some really important things that happen in games that have changed the way people, or I'm sorry, have shed light on the way people learn and what people find interesting, like being competitive. So in Instremia, you can see how many words you've learned so far and your progress towards those, how many exercises you've done. Those can all be good
Where I
things,
see value. I mean, that's
but
where I
yeah,
see
I don't think.
value of
Oh, sorry, go
gamification.
ahead.
Well, I'm just saying that's kind of where I see how gamification can work, just to have kind of like a progress bar or something to show you that you've like achieved something.
Yeah, exactly. So it can do lots of things for like motivation and even help us understand how interaction is important for people to stay engaged. I think there's so much to learn from games, but I don't think they need to be spliced in a way that they're kind of like the sugar that goes with the medicine or something like that. I think learning itself is fascinating and fun if you can get it happening the right way.
Right.
So,
well, can you... Sorry, I didn't understand. Are you saying that they'll splice in games that have nothing to do with the topic being learned?
Yeah, they'll have absolutely nothing to do with it. So if you go to like BBC Languages, for example, and you go to their like Spanish games section,
mm-hmm.
they actually have this. You can play like...
Yeah, it'll be like spell out the word before it falls to the bottom sort of thing.
No, it's not even that.
Oh, really?
So they'll have like multiple choice language questions, and then once you get enough of them right, you can play like a Space Invaders game for 30 seconds, and then you go back to the Spanish. And I think like the goal of doing this is that it keeps the student from getting frustrated or something. Like, I think there is actual like psychological justification for this, but I think it really fails from the learning perspective, where you're kind of creating this pattern of like, okay, students, learning itself is terrible, but if you don't do it in too long of a stretch, it won't be that bad, you know? Like,
Which isn't the idea you want to get across, really.
Yeah,
especially
exactly.
Children. I think it should all... I mean, it's just... I think it'd be better to have games that are focused on the topic, but not quite what you were saying, like do this in, or spell the correct word before the timer is up, something like that. I'm not sure about that, but more like role-playing games or...
Yeah, I think there's a lot that can be done, and I think there's tons of games that use language that in interesting ways, right? Like, we don't have to...
Like strategy games, where you're using the language strategically to win...
Yeah.
Exactly. To
complete
a task.
Or any kind of like role playing or virtual reality type thing. There's so much that can be done in that space. That is really cool. There's just so much technology out there where it's like, okay, learning a language is gonna require a lot of mundane repetition, so we're gonna try to, you know, mix it up. But but you know, there is to some extent you are going to have to do mundane repetition in learning a language, which hopefully, you know, the progress points and the competitive nature can help.
But I think if you put it in context, it's a lot less mundane.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that really gets back to kind of merging these two fields of how the learners are actually learning, you know, and this adaptive learning with the actual content development, so that you can continually improve both fronts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that actually gets back to our last question of, you know, why, well, what do you think about the content-focused methodology? So actually having people learn from content directly and kind of the scaffolding that we try to build into teaching, helping people understand content. And then also, please feel free to share any suggestions you have for making either in streaming or Spanish MOOC from the little that you've been able to ascertain about it better.
Well, as I said before, I really think content-focused language learning is the best way, because you're putting the language in a content for this, or in the context for the student, and they're kind of picking it apart. I think picking it apart and kind of learning through through deductive reasoning, I think that's kind of like the way a student will really understand something on their own, instead of having... I mean, it's good to have a mix of explicit and implicit learning, and I think you really get that by going through the content instead of, like we were saying before, having memorized this list of vocabulary words, now listen to this dialogue that uses the vocabulary words. But having it all come from just like a complete material, I think that's really good for the student. I mean, and I'm just talking about myself here because I really enjoy learning that way. And I think I learn a lot because I can kind of, it's almost like a scavenger hunt of ideas. I'm looking for what's in the content that I can understand.
Yeah, I really like that.
And the more you do it, the more you understand until eventually you feel like you understand it fully.
Yeah. And that really builds on the learner's autonomy as well, right? Where they start doing this stuff, they get, you know, they start to get the hang of it, and then they can go take that same approach towards other things, and they become these independent learners. I love that.
Yeah, definitely.
I've heard this described in layman's terms in at least a couple of ways. One of them was, you need to make a million mistakes to learn a language. And then another one is, learning happens in those aha moments where you're like, oh, that makes sense now.
Yeah, definitely. It's the figuring it out part that really, where the learning happens.
Yeah, I love that that perspective that you shared just now. I think that really mirrors my own experience with studying languages as well. So very cool. And so, for maybe our last question, did you have any recommendations or thoughts about InStreamia or Spanish MOOC?
I did have some thoughts. I don't know if you already incorporate it. You might already incorporate these things. But one of them I already mentioned was kind of taking field trips with Google Earth. And something else I mentioned, which I guess you might do with the graders, but having kind of appointments to meet with native speakers, even if it's only for maybe like 5 or 10 minutes to have quick conversations.
Yeah.
Do you do that with the Google Hangout?
So the Google Hangouts, at least in the first iteration of Spanish MOOC, have been primarily among students to give them a chance to practice and kind of get out of their comfort zone, because it was a Spanish 100, so it's kind of really beginner level. Mm-hmm. So that's where we started. I think especially once we get into Spanish 200, we'll start incorporating native speakers more and more into those Hangouts and things. And I do want to incorporate more into 100 as well.
And another thing was maybe having kind of speaking games or speaking activities during the Google Hangout. So not just having like regular practice conversation, but making it like a sort of game. Well, we were just talking about games. So making it a game.
We had a few of those. We had one, for example, where like, one person would ask about a third person's age, and then that second person would have to ask the other person and kind of report back to the first person, sort of interactive icebreaker games. But I think even more of that is definitely a possibility, and I like that idea. Oh, one more thing I wanted to tell you about with the feedback loop that I didn't have a chance to mention earlier. One of the features that we're developing is kind of like at tagging. So, for example, if one of the mistakes that you as a teacher were to identify in one of your students' assignments was with the verb llamar, rather than having to write out this explanation on a one-by-one, kind of the one-at-a-timing-it approach, we're trying to develop a system of indexing so that you can just say, hey, you messed up llamar, click this link, and it'll tell you what you did wrong and what you're supposed to do.
So good.
So that, you know, what's the saying? Give a man a fish and you feed him for a day. This is my entire philosophy around like interactions and communicating. It's all scalability all the time. I don't even tell people how to like log into their accounts anymore. I just send them to a link that tells them how to log into their account. No.
That's really cool. I like that idea.
But then they get a much more polished, pristine interactive answer to that question that includes videos, includes exercises, that includes thorough explanations, rather than just like a sloppy paragraph that I threw together to fulfill the need of letting them know that they did something wrong, right?
Right. No, it's leading them to practice more or to learn more about what mistake they made. But it's good. I really like that.
Yeah, it would be really cool.
You change kind of, I don't know, evolve with the digital media is to understand when that the student really can have access to everything and they should have access to everything whenever they need it.
Yeah, exactly. And it would, the really cool thing, which we'd love to see happen, what we're hoping for is that when students start seeing this hashtagging, they can say, okay, I'm writing a word with Yamar and I have no idea what I'm doing. I'm not going to just write something and then see what the grader says. I'm going to go ahead and check that hashtag to see if there's.
So would you make something like that for like major verbs, major like grammatical features, things like that? Or like you said, you're just going to see like common mistakes and make those kind of the indexing for the common mistakes. So it would be,
I think it'll become an evolving library of explanations. That, you know, as it grows, especially with 400 plus teachers that we have on in LT MOOC, this army of experts going about this common goal of making it so that people can learn on these pinpoint issues, I think we'll get all that. So I think we'll get common mistakes. I think we'll get common verbs, common grammar principles. Basically, everything that you'd want to put into your textbook also gets a section in it and an at tag or whatever, or a hashtag.
Yeah.
And that's... one of the things we can actually do is we can recognize after, I mean, we're parsing through every piece of sentence, every single sentence they write, we identify what words they use. And so we can just say, oh, look, a student who's using Yamar, who hasn't done the Yamar exercise yet. Right? We have all this information.
Wow, like, so you can really pinpoint that just automatically?
Yeah. Well, we just have to write the algorithms to do it. But yeah, we're already indexing every single word form of every single sentence any student writes at any point.
Language will have a hashtag.
Pretty much, yeah. Well, and in fact, we already do have this integrated dictionary that they can click on and see examples of the usage. We'd love to see our students use that more and avoid the mistakes, because I think if you look at 10 examples of how even Yamar, for example, is used, you know, you can probably get an idea. But, I mean, it's good for, as Scott said before, it's good for students to make mistakes and realize because you see it being used that way doesn't mean that it can't be used another way.
What if the student is typing their assignment through in Streamia and it's able to tell them like right away that they're making a mistake, kind of? Do you think that would be helpful for a student?
So the problem is, this gets back to the fact that Spanish language itself is not a standardized language. So it's really hard for computers to identify these complicated mistakes. So there's a limit, but yeah, we do it as they're typing it.
Okay.
Every single sentence they hit the save button after, we do it one sentence at a time just so we don't have to, you know, it reduces our server load.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, once they hit save for that sentence, it'll show them what word forms they use. They can put their mouse over it and see, that alta is the feminine form, or that Gustar is being used in, you know, whatever particular verb form it's being used in.
That's so helpful.
Yeah. So, like, it's all right there. We just have to start, you know, making it into a more of a educational experience where it guides them through the process a little bit better, because someone who's used to learning languages and someone who's familiar with our platform, like, there's really no limit to what they can do. I mean, you can pick up new languages on this thing so quickly. Like Scott and I, neither of us speak Italian or Portuguese, which are two of the languages we offer that we don't speak. But just knowing our own structure, it's really...
Have you ever looked at the Code Academy website?
Yeah, I have, actually. Yeah, that's really cool. And they do a lot of that kind of stuff, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, they kind of do a lot of, they do a lot of guiding, which I thought about how that could apply to language, foreign language learning, not just programming language learning.
Yeah.
And just like very step by step, and then you can write everything and click save, and they'll tell you what you did.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And this sort of syntaxing that computers have learned how to do for the sake of programming is exactly the tool set that has allowed for natural language processing. I mean, they obviously have some differences, but you can see the incredible overlap of, computers learning how to read machine code or, evolving into a programming language and then evolving into like natural language. It's pretty cool.
It's almost like the difference between trying to have a computer, this is a harsh analogy, but having a scanner read printed out text is easy. Having a scanner trying to read handwriting is extremely difficult. It's like it's unfair to say, oh, Codecademy can do it for code.
Yeah, that's true. But the idea is cool.
They're really lucky though, right? It's like we're trying to teach code, which is something that by definition computers understand, so
Yeah, kind of does some of the work for them.
yeah.
I hope that was helpful.
That was
Yeah,
very
definitely,
helpful.
definitely.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you. I really appreciate you inviting me for this interview. Okay,
Have
thank you.
a good
Have a
night.
good night.
Thanks. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.